Welcome to the Misophonia International Podcast. Today, our research director, Dr. Jennifer Jo Brout, will be discussing misophonia with the researcher, Dr. Stephen Porges.
I'm sure you're asked about the polyvagal theory all the time. However, for some of our listeners, this is a new theory. So, if you wouldn't mind, would you briefly just explain the theory?
Okay, so it all depends upon literally where you sit in terms of what you want to hear regarding the polyvagal theory. But what most people are interested in is the fact that there's a tight relationship between our autonomic state, how our visceral organs are regulated, and how we regulate the muscles in our face and head. And this becomes quite relevant to those who are interested in the extraction of voice from background sounds, or those who are hypersensitive to sounds, because the neural regulation of our internal organs is literally helping in a way to regulate the neural tone to the muscles of our face and head, so that when our body needs to mobilize to fight and to flee, it changes the neural tone to our muscles of our face, so that we lose our positive engagement expressions. And now our hearing apparatus is now biased towards detecting sounds of predator and danger. So we reorganize. The issue is, when we're in that type of state, we're doing very well in fighting off people coming close to us, but we do very poorly in engaging others. So polyvagal theory explains that as a function of evolution, our nervous system evolved three separate circuits to regulate our visceral and our physiological state. A circuit that is a circuit of safety and calmness, and where we engage other people, we can hear their voices. Our voices become more melodic with greater intonation, and that feeds back in terms of how we regulate our own hearing, and that calms us down. And then a state that supports fight and flight to mobilize, that shifts our bias towards auditory detection of predator. And then we have another state, which is a state literally of being inanimate, of disappearing. And individuals who have had severe crises, severe trauma experiences, often have shifted into a bodily state where their body just tried to disappear. The consequences of going into that trauma type state is that we never want to go back there. And so people who have often experienced that utilize fight-flight mobilization to keep themselves out of it. Not that they utilize it on a voluntary level, their body adjusts to it. So rather than going into the chaos of immobilization, their body just mobilizes.
So are you saying that if you have been through a trauma that has put you in somewhat of a freeze state, that in order to not return to it, your body automatically goes to fight flight, so you're over aroused all the time?
Right. So what we're really, none of this is an intentional or voluntary behavior.
Right.
There are adaptive functions that our body evolved to have. So if you've had, in a sense, a history of immobilization, and it could even be not something as I was going to term innocuous, and it's not really innocuous, medical procedures. Medical procedures are always associated with immobilization.
Right.
And if you sit still, if someone is, in a sense, in a room with you and they think you're calm and they're talking calmly to you, and suddenly your body starts to immobilize with calmness, that immobilization is going to send cues back to you, to your nervous system, and it may actually trigger a sense of being immobilized in defense. And
that is
so
very interesting.
Yeah. Well, as a clinician, I'm sure you have observed some of these features where where people, when you try to, you think you're doing the right thing by calming them, and suddenly they jump out of the chair and run around. And what they're doing is really the cues of that immobilization, of what we would call immobilization without fear, become cues of immobilization with fear to them, and their body kicks into, in a sense, a hyperdrive to say, I'm not going there, because that was death to me.
That was a horrible place to be in.
Right, right.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. The irony of all this is that the anticipation of going into that place, that physiological state, may be much worse than actually re-experiencing it. So, I see, when people learn that they can go into that physiological state and then use a resource, whether it's a friend or learning how to breathe or using a different mental image, that they can go back and forth, and suddenly the going into that physiological state no longer carries the terror with it.
That is very fascinating. I had never thought of it that way. Thank you for that wonderful explanation.
Well, thank you. Let me elaborate one other point, and that is individuals who often have experienced these immobilization, you know, experiences often do high-risk behaviors. They often are not only very active individuals, but they often will do high-risk behaviors. And those high-risk behaviors frequently are associated with moving a lot of mobilization. So they don't revisit the patience, the calmness, because of those cues will set them off again.
Because really the calmness isn't really calmness. It's really more like what you would think of in an animal as tonic immobility. Is that correct?
Well, the calmness, it may have the initial features of being calm, but calmness carries with it vulnerability. And the body can't go into that state of vulnerability, so it reacts to it. So the cues of immobilizing. So if you were to ask, the metaphor that I use is that the goal in life is to feel safe in the arms of an appropriate mammal.
Mm-hmm.
Because some people like dogs more than they like
people. Right. Yes. Yes. I love my dog.
Yes. And you feel safe with your dog, and your dog feels safe with you. And this is, in a sense, the whole essence of what it is to be a mammal, and that is to co-regulate with another appropriate species.
That makes perfect sense. Could you bring that back a little bit to sound sensitivity?
Oh, yeah. So if we think of sound sensitivity as an adaptive feature that has benefits, then
mm-hmm.
suddenly it doesn't really, we remove the pathology or the medicalization of what it really is. Sound sensitivities are not sensitivities across the entire acoustic spectrum. They tend to be sensitivities towards lower frequencies and difficulty in processing and extracting voice from complex, noisy backgrounds. And that's an adaptive function, because when you're in a state of fight-flight, when you're trying to defend yourself, it's the low-frequency rumble of predator that has been wired into our nervous system. And so that sound sensitivity is really sensitivity and an advantage to detect low-frequency sounds.
And also, I recall you telling me once that it's the lack of prosody or modulation.
Well,
in voice as well.
Right. Well. So on one level, you have sound sensitivity. That's the sensory or receptive side of the system. But if you listen to the voices of the same people who have sound sensitivity, often their voices are not prosodic. They don't have the melodic intonation of voice.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's part of the same neural circuit that's adjusting to deal with danger as part of the vigilance, the hypervigilance circuit. So it's all adaptive. And so the triggers or the critical point of this is how do you shift the state of the organism so that the organism doesn't have to be hypervigilant. So the cues of safety, and this is where our earlier discussions were about, that the cues of safety are actually taught to us by a mother when she picks up the newborn baby.
Right.
When she talks in motherese.
Exactly.
Or the intonation. Yeah. And lullabies, nursery rhymes, where people, in a sense, exaggerate the intonation of the voice when they talk to a young child. And most people do that to their dogs and to their cats.
Yes.
they do a much better job of sending those cues of safety through prosody and intonation with their pets than they do with their children or their spouses or significant others. It's to me, it's really amazing how we talk to each other versus how intuitively correct we are when we talk to our pets.
That's a very, very interesting point. That is a very interesting point.
Well, what we do is we learn that there are triggers that were embedded in our nervous system to trigger safety. And if we listen to classical music and understand how composers structured their compositions, they started the compositions often with elaborations of Mahler's lullabies. And that's all, I'm going to say, not trivially, but that's what Mozart did. These are very simple lullabies often that are started with, and they're in the range of a mother's voice. In orchestra, they're violins, flutes, clarinet. So it's in the exact frequency range of a female voice. And once the individual becomes safe and comfortable with that melody or with that frequency band, the melody then goes to lower pitched instruments. So we now can, in a sense, expand the acoustic range that we feel safe in. And that's what the first movement of many classical compositions deals with. But
now,
what is the second? Yeah, go ahead, Jenny.
Oh, I was sorry to interrupt. I have a few questions about that. The first is, are there any predators that, for example, do not make noise in the low frequency range? And what I'm specifically thinking about are birds, which were, of course, once very large and preyed upon infants, human infants, and which, for example, I, as someone with misophonia, find very irritating and frightening.
Yeah. The part with birds, we have the birds are not our direct ancestors, so they broke off of reptiles long after mammals. So I tend not to think too much about birds. But I want you to think, really, initially, mammals were very small, and they had to evolve to find a frequency band to communicate about their state of their own bodies so they could mate, they could be safe with another. So vocalizations initially were about conveying a physiological state to another conspecific of the same species.
Okay.
But what you're really describing, if we start to think about sounds and basically the evolution of or the coevolution of how acoustic signals interface with mammals and especially humans, we would clearly identify high-frequency, unmodulated sounds as shrill shrieks of danger. And when we hear that, we don't run away from it. We tend to look towards it. So
are we freezing?
No, I don't think we're freezing. I think they're distress sounds, and we're wired to comfort, to help, and to help to basically save. So when
there's also the infant sounds.
Yeah.
You're saying because they're also the infant sounds. I see.
Yeah. Yeah, so now, you know, if you accidentally stepped on your pet's foot, whether it's a cat or a dog,
and
they give a very high-pitched cry. Do you look down at the pet, or do you walk away? Or if someone else steps on
you? Completely startled, and the first thing you think is, oh my goodness, what did I do? And is my pet okay?
Is your pet okay is really the initial drive. And when a baby falls and cries, it's the same thing. Is my child okay? So it has a high frequency and it doesn't have much variability, so it's a shrill type sound. And even in newborns, when a baby has a high shrill cry, they call it the cri de chat or cry of the cat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a clinical index of something not going very well. So even in medicine, they were using the sounds of voices to indicate whether the physiology of the baby was healthy. Okay, now there's an important reason why that occurs, and that is the nerves that regulate our heart and bronchi, a nerve called the vagus, which gives us the ability to calm down and creates this variability that represents health, also has a nerve, the vagus has a nerve that controls our laryngeal and pharyngeal activity, and so that the pitch and the prosodic intonation, that variability of intonation, is also regulated by a vagal nerve. And in a way, it's a parallel pathway of our visceral state. So the intonation of our voice is conveying our bodily state and signaling that we're safe to come close to. And if we were to map all the feedback loops out, we'd find out that if we had prosodic voice, it would also help calm us down. And of course, the history of this is well known. People sing, and a lot of people sing to calm down.
Yeah.
And people feel better after singing. So all these things have been known intuitively, but there's a neurophysiology to it. And also the idea of listening to music as calming is part of the same system, because as we process those sounds, those cues of the mother ease, the melodic voice, that feedback to our middle ear structures that help us pull out those frequencies also helps us calm by increasing the vagal influence to our heart and bronchi, so we feel better.
So with people specifically who have misophonia, you're familiar with some of the noises that are most often.
Yes.
Chewing, coughing, sneezing, even breathing. Can you tell me what you think might be going on?
Well, we've just, we're looking at some of the data, the stimuli that Mercedes has. We've actually started processing those. And they have, like lip smacking, slurping, crinkling.
Yes.
I can't remember all of them. But they are uniquely different than music. They're different than other, let's use the term biological sounds. They're both positive and negative. And they're different than most bodily sounds, the sounds that we detected or used from the IADS, that international affective
digital
acoustic sound.
But
what we're going to do next is, based on the acoustic features that we're describing, we are going to simulate a sound. We're actually going to create a composite simulated sound based on the acoustic features. So we're going to reverse engineer what would bother a misophonic individual. Okay, so we're saying, okay, we know what you guys are rating as being upsetting. They have certain acoustic common features that distinguish them from other classes of sounds. Now let's create an archetypical disruptive sound so that we can literally understand it more. And that's what we're trying to do right now.
And that to me, of course, as you know, is something I've wanted to do for 20 years, is to deconstruct these sounds, because we're not talking about random sounds. Most people are complaining about very much similar sounds and the same sounds.
Right. And so we've been using a new type of analysis called modulation power spectrum analysis. And we've been using other forms of acoustic analysis, and we're able to isolate those sounds that bother people with misophonia. We can actually characterize them with what the analyses are telling us, and now we want to reconstruct it to talk about the core disruptive signal, and then we can understand more about what people are responding to. So initially, I thought it was more to do with predator-type sounds, and we had a discussion on that, and that there were two parts in misophonia, I thought. One was this triggering of a defense, and the other one was an association, so that you had certain cues that were associative cues, basically learned through occurring at the same time, and other parts that were truly neurobiological. Now I think it may be very, very specific that you don't need a learning curve, that there may be just very specific sounds in which the body reacts to, and if you're in a specific physiological state. So we will know more about this, I would say, within a month.
Oh, that's excellent news. And then what can we do with this research going forward?
Okay, so the real question for me will be, if the neural exercises of middle ear structures that dampen out the input of low-frequency sounds will be sufficient to minimize disruptive effects of the sounds that affect people with misophonia. So what I'm really saying is there's an intervening variable. So if we go back to our old classes in psychology where people talked about intervening variables,
yes,
they talked about stimulus response models, the reason misophonia has been misunderstood is
mm-hmm.
that it doesn't affect everyone.
Right.
So it's not a law of nature that you have a stimulus and you get a response. You have that stimulus and some people have a response. What I want to do is explain that if you understand the intervening physiological state, then you have a law of nature, because what you're saying is in a given physiological state, that stimulus will always produce a response, so that the treatment model is to understand how to shift physiological state. Does that make any sense?
Yes. So correct me if I'm wrong, but are you saying that if you are in a very calm physiological state,
I think I can run with that a little bit. If you're in
okay.
a calm physiological state, then the certain sounds will literally be bouncing off your eardrums and not penetrating them. And those sounds will have primarily in lower frequencies. So there are two parts of what's affecting a misophonic individual. One, of course, is part of the frequencies. The other is the pattern of the sounds. So you have the actual frequencies in it, and then the predictability or the lack of predictability of the sounds.
So either the repetition or the novelty.
Right. So in a way, there's a structure or lack of structure to the sounds, and if the structure has a type of rhythmic repetition, it could be upsetting. It's like a leg that is being, people with restless leg, that a couple restless leg movements are okay, but after a while or after a few of them, it becomes very disruptive. Or what I would also probably say is that many people who have symptoms of misophonia probably cannot stand being put on hold and listening to the music that is in the background.
That is probably true.
Well, I would say that for an individual who just goes ballistic, that's me. I'd much rather have silence.
I agree with that.
Yeah, so it's both a distractor and it has a type of structure. So what we want to be able to do is actually articulate exactly what it is that the nervous system is identifying. The excitement of processing the sounds that Mercedes has used is that they cluster so close together. So it was very nice. So that the analysis said, yeah, there's something very special about this group, and it's different than music, and it's different than babbling brooks, or it's very different. And it's different than a person vomiting, and it's different than a person retching. It's different. Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the things that you were saying, which I have found, is there is a repetitive element to a lot of the sounds.
Yeah. I don't want to say too much because I don't want to say anything that we don't know yet, but we will learn more in the next few weeks, and then, that will be shared with you and with your on your webpage. We will provide you with the figures to explain it.
That's very exciting. And then from there, what will we be able to do to give some hopeful treatment.
Well, my strategy has been that if you can shift the physiological state, then the nervous system no longer focuses on these stimuli, no longer have their high balance. So they're, I think the disruptive nature of these cues is that the nervous system treats them with high balance. For some reason or somehow they become important. And once they're in the background, they're no longer really in the background. They're in the foreground and everything else goes to the background.
Right. So we're talking about really, again, self-regulation and lower arousal level so that these noises which bother us for whatever reason, they're kicking off perhaps evolutionary response or lack of auditory gating. If one is in a lower arousal state,
we're going to change the word from arousal to talk in terms of a more positive, interactive, calming state. So there's a physiological state that is truly the state of being safe. It's not the same as being in a state in which there is no threat. So we tend to think that we're safe when there is no threat, but our nervous system may not be safe when there is no threat. And what we're really talking about are what are the cues that retune and shift our physiology to a state of safety. And when we're in those different states, those different states are intervening variables for how we process those acoustic signals. So the intervention model has to be targeted at shifting the physiological state. It's not merely going around.
Safety. Yet. And, of course, being safe subsumes lower arousal, but lowering arousal is not enough because you also have to feel safe. So it's both the physiological state and the emotional connection.
Right. But when you're safe, you can mobilize and rapidly calm. So you have this great flexibility of both behavior, thought process, and state. So it's a resource. When you are in a sense in a chronic fight-flight state, defensive most of the time, you can appear to be calm. But once you use the motor movement, that motor movement then becomes a cue, not of engaging another person, but of being defensive.
Right.
So the nervous system is very smart, but when it gets stuck in certain states, it's smart for that state of defending, but the ability to engage and to calm and to calm another is really literally off the table. The system can't do it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And there are consequences.
What the response looks like.
Right. There are consequences in terms not merely of social behavior, but the physiological state that we're describing also interferes with health. So it disrupts our health. And so safety, the beautiful part of the narrative, the story, mm-hmm. is that when we're safe, our physiology works to help us not only optimize our life experiences, but optimize our health.
Well, I think a lot of people with misophonia, as well as many disorders where one is dysregulated, feel very tired all the time, get sick more often, and I think that's what you're saying, if I'm correct.
Oh, absolutely. They're not being rejuvenated through their interactions with others. They're really being, in a sense, exhausted by it.
That's exactly right. Exactly. I have one, this has just been fascinating, and I have one broader question, which perhaps people have asked you many times, but I think it's very relevant to today. How can we feel safe in a world that is so unsafe when we are primed to be in defense mode to survive?
I think it is very relevant, your point, and it brings us back to really our own evolutionary heritage, and that is safety, starts with the dyad. It starts with a small group. It starts with people who are close enough to help each other regulate the physiology. So if we thought of social behavior as a neural exercise of helping us co-regulate our physiology, in a sense, enabling our physiology to feel safe and for us to feel safe, I think the world would be different. When we mobilize people with fear, and this is what you're saying, and it's everywhere,
yes. And
it's very upsetting, and we feel it in our body. So if you watch the debates and you listen to the news, you feel it in your body, and you tend to feel it either in your gut, which is where you're saying, I can't do anything. It's a sense of helplessness. It's beyond being mobilized and anxious or angry. It hurts.
Yes.
Because the cues are cues not of love and caring. The cues are cues of disruption and chaos. And we don't like that as a species. So the way that it will work out, or has to work out, is that we have to appreciate what it is that shifts our physiological state to feel loving kindness, to feel, the word that I like to use is to feel welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
And when we feel welcoming, we are respectful of others, and it's a synergistic way in which we are regulating ourselves by helping other people regulate. So when we say a kind thing to another person and they turn towards us with a smile, we've gained a lot.
Right.
We didn't give anything away. We got something from that interaction. We have to learn that being generous and being generous and welcoming is what this is all about.
And that is different across cultures, obviously, and I think it's really coming through to the apex right now.
I think we have to go back and say that it has not been truly different across cultures. All cultures knew this within the family.
Mm-hmm.
But if you put too much pressure on the family, on the small units,
So
you put pressure in a sense if they didn't have enough food to eat or they were too dependent on others and then lost their jobs,
right.
Which is the history of what's happened in civilized countries, then everyone moves into a state of defensiveness because they're in a survival mode.
They're in survival mode. There's not enough resources.
Right.
Yeah.
Or even if there are enough resources, to think that there are not enough is enough to make people defensive. Remember, we live in a world that is really clouded with metaphor, meaning that when we think we have resources, we're talking about something in the bank. And when the concept of a bank becomes unstable, it permeates even through our metaphors. So we went through that. So even our metaphors of safety, our metaphors of believing that education was the route, all these metaphors that created what we were calling the American dream are dissolving in front of our eyes as the world changes.
Yes.
But what we have to always come back to is the root of being happy and successful is the capacity to be welcoming and to co-regulate with others. To play and to smile.
Right. I think that is just an amazing and wonderful statement that you just made, and I can't thank you enough for saying that, clarifying that, and for the interview, and I hope that you will speak to us again with the results of deconstruction of some of the sounds, and we can go further after that.
Well, I would love to, and I would love to do a couple other things with your community. One, I would like to put a questionnaire online to get information on literally body awareness and bodily type reactions. I'd like to learn more about the intervening variables.
And you have that great scale.
Yeah. So I'd like to structure that. We can work together on that. And the other
when we
simulate this, the archetypical disruptive sound, I would actually like to be on your webpage and to get feedback from people.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
So, like,
we will absolutely set that up.
Yeah. So that I'm looking forward to. I'm looking forward to all the interactions.
As am I. We will set that up very quickly so we can get going with that, because that's very exciting for all of us.
Okay, that's wonderful.
Thank you for everything, and thank you for everything that you're doing for Misophonia. We all really appreciate it, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Jennifer, but I think what we'll learn is that there are many people that would be on a spectrum with similar cues, and I'll use this term. Some of us have adapted, and some of us have more difficulty in adapting. But there's sensitivity amongst many people. We just haven't, so many people haven't acknowledged this. So if we start talking about sound sensitivities, we're talking about probably somewhere in the numbers of probably 20% of the population has
right.
sound sensitivities, but they attribute it to all kinds of different things. You know, they create a narrative that explains why they have it, and they then create a career in which they don't have to be exposed to it. And some
right.
people have that luxury, but if you are a child or if you're young and you don't have that flexibility, then you're being, in a sense, it's a, I was going to use the word torture, but
it really is.
Mm-hmm.
It is. It's like post-traumatic stress without the actual stressor having occurred every day of your life. I mean, you're just...
Well, I think it will end up, for many individuals, there'll be overlapping symptomatology. The
yes.
issue is whether there's an identifiable traumatic event that triggered this, or whether it just kind of slipped in through,
right.
You know, through some let's even use the term minor disruption or apparent minor disruption in developmental trajectory. Let's say even illness, which resolved but didn't really resolve in all levels. So some of the, I would say, neural regulation of the muscles that would be used to dampen these sounds and dampen these sensitivity just didn't recover. And that's
with
part of my
here.
Yeah. And so for me, the reason I have a real close interest in this is that I had, as a child, I had a mastoid infection on my right side and literally lost hearing for a long time. And then I really didn't process sounds well on the right side. And some of us have had our own little journey.
We've had our own experiences that bring us to do this work.
Yeah. But but having experiences provides us with an understanding of what we're working with. And what I often used to say, it's nothing wrong with using yourself as your own personal laboratory. It's helpful.
I agree with that. It's certainly helpful as a clinician, and it's certainly helpful as a researcher. There's nothing like experiencing something in your own body to make you understand it better.
Yeah. And even if you don't experience some of the issues, you have to literally go into try to be aware of what it would be like if you had those experiences. So you have to play a little neural exercise with yourself. You got to move into another person's, literally into their skin and see what
into
it's like.
Into their skin, yep.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, again, thank you so much. And I look forward to more interaction and to hearing about results and getting everything going on the website so we can move forward with all of this work. And again, thank you for everything, and have a wonderful weekend, Steve.
Well, thank you, Jennifer, and I enjoyed talking to you, and I look forward to
enjoy talking to you. It's always completely fascinating.
Well, thank you, and I'm looking forward to the good things we'll do together.
Oh, thank you. I am too, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Take care, Steve.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.